From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And of course, we're following breaking news as usual. Now, yesterday we spoke with Nebraska Senator Colby Koash. Jeremy, you remember he's pushing to get his very red state legislature to repeal the death penalty.
Yeah.
Yep, he finds it too costly, also in his view, anti-life. Well, today, Nebraska voted, the legislature voted to abolish the death penalty.
And it looks like with enough votes to override the governor's expected veto. This is surprising a lot of people. We'll follow that story. But right now, let's get to Washington, where the Senate is expected to vote tomorrow on an extension of three key provisions of the Patriot Act, which expire on June 1st. The most controversial is Section 215, which allows the government to collect and store phone records in bulk. Think Edward Snowden and all that he revealed. It's something that a court has said is illegal, something the House has voted to end. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell disagrees with House Republicans, and in order to sort out the differences, he wants to extend the Patriot Act deadline by another 2 months. Elsa Chang is NPR's congressional correspondent following developments from Capitol Hill. She joins us now. Hi, Elsa.
Hi there.
And let's remind listeners the real sticking point here, Section 215. What exactly does it do? What kind of data does it allow the government to collect?
Yeah, Section 215 collects what's called phone metadata, and it's very important to remember that's not the content of phone conversations. Some people, I think, have been misperceiving that it actually approaches that. But metadata is what you'd find in a phone bill, right? Like phone numbers you've called, dates and times of those calls and duration of those calls. And the data is a way for the government to figure out who else a potential terrorism suspect may be plotting with. What the government has been doing is collecting this data, storing it, and then accessing it when there's reasonable suspicion someone might be involved in terrorism.
So let's talk about what the House has done. The USA Freedom Act is what has been passed in the House in order to restrict that collection of phone records. How does that change the way things are done, if that were to pass through the Senate, of course?
Right, exactly. I mean, the House overwhelmingly passed it. And what the bill does is it would prevent the government from collecting and storing this metadata. Instead, only the phone companies would store the data, which they're already doing. And if the government wants to get any of those phone records, it must first get a court order. The idea is making the government go through this additional hurdle of getting a court order would bring it more in line with Fourth Amendment requirements. But there are lawmakers who hate this whole Section 215 program, don't think this bill goes far enough to roll back the program. They say mass surveillance would still be going on. The government can still get its hands on this data, and just making them jump through this extra hoop doesn't do enough to avoid possible Fourth Amendment violations.
And the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he's going to bring this USA, or at least he wants to bring this USA Freedom Act bill to the Senate floor for a vote. But he also wants to extend the deadline. What's going on there?
Right. So, yes, McConnell wants the current program to continue. He thinks that's what's best for national security. And by bringing the House bill to the floor, I think he wants to prove that there aren't enough votes in the Senate to get that bill passed in the chamber. Hmm. I guess the thinking is, let's prove to everyone this bill will fail, so then we will have to come up with some other alternative. And the supporters of the House bill in the Senate do concede that it will be a struggle to get those 60 votes, even if there's a strong showing among Democrats, because some moderate Republicans still have real issues with the House bill. For example, Susan Collins of Maine told me that she isn't so sure phone companies can be trusted to keep this data long enough in all cases. She says she can picture a scenario where the phone companies start marketing themselves as the company that won't let the government get its hands on your data. So she fears companies would decide to just get rid of the records after a very short period of time. And Democrats have similar concerns, like Dianne Feinstein of California, for example. She's thinking she's kind of readying another measure that would require phone companies to hang on to this data for at least 2 years.
Where does the White House stand on all this?
So the White House says it supports the House bill. I mean, because it's a great middle ground. There are provisions in the House bill that overlap with proposals the White House had itself suggested quite a while ago. Like under the House measure, there's another provision that would provide for a panel of experts to advocate for privacy and civil liberties concerns before this secret intelligence court, where a lot of these 215 requests go to. And that's something the White House has suggested a long time ago, has been on board with. So the House measure overlaps with that.
Are you expecting this is going to be sorted out this week, or is this going to go on for a couple more months?
It's the most likely scenario right now is that the Senate will pass a very short-term extension of the current bill so they can wrangle through a possible bigger compromise when they all return from recess. But it has a lot of work to do. It has to get through trade and highway funding. And then there's a question of would the House even pass a short-term extension of the Patriot Act, because a lot of people in that chamber do not support that.
Lots going on in Washington. Elsa Chang speaking with us from Capitol Hill about the Patriot Act. Elsa, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, there's big news shaking up the charity world. The Federal Trade Commission is charging four cancer charities with lying to donors and misusing almost $200 million in donations in one of the largest charity fraud cases ever. James T. Reynolds started what the government says is a fraudulent charity empire in 1987 with Cancer Fund of America. The other charities are run by his ex-wife, a son, and a family friend. They're the Breast Cancer Society, the Children's Cancer Fund of America, and Cancer Support Services. The FTC says less than 3% of the money raised actually went to patients. $120 million went to fundraising firms to keep the lie going, and that outside of that, groups were de facto employment agencies for friends and family members who pulled down high salaries and pulled out cash as if the charities were piggy banks for things like cars, tuition, luxury vacations. Suzanne Perry is with the Chronicle of Philanthropy. And Suzanne, you and other watchdogs were calling out these groups for years. So why did the FTC take so long to bring charges?
Well, I would say that we've been hearing for several years that they were looking into this. I think it was about 5 years ago that the investigation started. It's kind of a half glass empty, half glass full thing. Why did it take so long? I think that everyone in the charitable world who cares about ethics agrees that charity regulators are underfunded, under-resourced. You know, the Congress just keeps cutting back on the IRS, which has some regulatory authority. State attorneys general don't give this top priority in general. The glass half full part is that I believe they took so long partly to build a really solid case. These are some very complicated charges. Yeah. And I think they also wanted to get all 50 states on board and the FTC. So it was a big management coordination challenge. Yeah. And it's the first time that all these entities have cooperated in a charity fraud case.
It's unprecedented in that way. And we know the investigation began with an assistant attorney general in New Mexico, Elizabeth Corsmo. And now two of the funds have settled, the Breast Cancer Society and the Children's Cancer Fund. Those were run by James Reynolds' son, James Reynolds II, and James Reynolds' ex-wife, Rose Perkins. So those funds are now going to be dissolved, and those two will be banned from fundraising. But some would say, is that all? They don't go to jail for this?
No, they're not going to jail. I think it was part of just getting them to settle. The charities will be put out of business. They are supposed to pay some fines, so to speak, but it's somewhat limited how much they have to pay. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the groups that didn't settle, which includes Cancer Fund of America, and James Reynolds Sr., sort of the mastermind of everything. They have not settled, but for the moment, that's right. The charities are put out of business, and that was seemed to be the main goal of the regulators.
But the question people have is, how did these groups get away with this for so long? What were some of the things that they were spending the money on?
One way they get away with it is that they have some accounting tricks that hide what they're doing. So if you looked at their public Form 990 tax filing, for example, it might look like they're spending a lot on programs and very little on fundraising or administrative expenses. And one way they do that, which was highlighted by this case, is they count donated goods. They get donated goods that they value highly and then report that they've distributed them, and they're able to count that as a program cost. Now, this case found that a lot of the so-called donated goods were just sort of sham operations. They were recording them, but they weren't really getting them or distributing them.
Well, for instance, they might get a box of Debbie's cakes or something, and it wouldn't even go to any cancer victims. It might go to local firefighters just to get rid of it, but they would really inflate the value of that.
That can happen, or sometimes, like in the case of the Breast Cancer Society, They said they were sending all these shipments overseas to help cancer patients overseas. The problem with saying you send things overseas is there are no controls. You don't have to report on your tax forms where you sent them exactly. You just say, we ship these overseas. So it looks like you're, you know, you've got all these programs going.
Yeah, Suzanne, this is going to be chilling for people who contribute to charities, especially cancer charities. How do you know? Give us one tip. How do you know that the organization you're contributing to is actually spending that money on the cause?
The best thing to do, I think, is to do as much research as possible. There are several charity watchdog types organizations out there: Charity Navigator, BBB, Wise Giving Alliance, Alliance, Charity Watch. And if all of them are giving a charity very bad grades or saying they're not filing the proper documents to be evaluated, that is a red flag.
Suzanne Perry with the Chronicle of Philanthropy will link people at hereandnow.org. One of the issues before the Supreme Court as it wraps up this session, lethal injections in death penalty cases involving a drug called midazolam. The case is brought by several Oklahoma death row inmates, and the justices are considering the questions just a year after the botched execution of Clayton Lockett. His execution in Oklahoma revealed to the general public that there's a shortage of the three drug cocktail usually used in executions. His case also launched a national debate on whether midazolam, the replacement, violates the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. Just how cruel is laid out in the cover story of this month's Atlantic Magazine. Jeffrey Stern wrote the story. And Jeffrey, start by reminding us why Oklahoma was using midazolam in the first place.
Just about every state that was carrying out lethal injections was using a drug called sodium thiopental, which is a cheap surgical drug. And there was a shortage in that began in 2009, and that kind of set off a series of alternatives as states sort of scrambled for other ways to execute people.
Well, take us through why there was a shortage. Hospira was the one manufacturer of the drug. The FDA, the government, found that there were problems, so they shut Hospira down. That set off the scramble, and initially, states in the U.S. found what they thought was a company in London?
That's right. So there was no longer any legal supplier of the drug. And it became unavailable because the FDA found some contamination in filling lines where Hospira was making this drug. States, because there is not a lot of medical expertise, which we can get into, that's brought to bear on these lethal injections, were reluctant at first to try other drugs, and they began looking, almost literally everywhere. They were looking overseas to try to get this same anesthetic, the same surgical drug.
They find this company in London, Dream Pharma. They start buying the sodium thiopental from Dream Pharma, but then you write about an anti-death penalty advocate from a group called Reprieve who decided to go find the company. What did she find?
She found that the company was not really a company, but actually it was just a cupboard in the back of a driving school. It was a driving academy on the outskirts of London. And in the back there was literally a cupboard where they were putting drugs and keeping them there until they were shipping them out to states in the U.S. that were using them for executions.
Well, she and her group put pressure on the British government to stop this. Britain doesn't have the death penalty. Ultimately, they're successful. So now you stumble onto another element of this story. It's one thing for a government to say, we're not going to help you carry out your executions. You write about how CEOs of companies, when they find out that states in the U.S. are trying to get this drug for executions, they say no.
Yeah, well, it's this interesting thing. I think we often think of Big Pharma as sort of anti-liberal left. But in this case, Big Pharma, just the pharmaceutical industry in general, and the kind of liberal anti-death penalty left are actually almost perfectly aligned, because there's really no interest for a pharmaceutical company in having their product be used for executions. It's totally anathema to what they design these products for. Once this drug shortage started and these sort of spectacular attempts to get drugs elsewhere began to surface, then there was a lot of pressure on the drug companies, and they didn't really have much interest in having their product be used. So they began taking eventually fairly proactive steps to keep the drugs out of the hands of execution states.
There's also pressure on the states, many of them very conservative states, which have, promised citizens that they'd carry out death penalties. It starts to get political. And also, you write that since the original manufacturer, Hospira, was the only FDA-approved company, the DEA is about to come down on states for, the illegal transfer of drugs from other countries?
Yeah, the prisons had become, in effect, drug smugglers. Now, the FDA had chosen not to really pay attention to this, but while the FDA was looking the other way, the DEA did not, and they actually began a series of raids and confiscated these drugs, or in some cases compelled the prisons to turn the drugs over.
Enter a reporter named Katie Fretland in your story. She found emails in 2011 between officials in Oklahoma because Texas was desperate to get some of the drugs that Oklahoma had at the time. What were those emails about?
So there was this sort of shady black market that was going on where states were sometimes supplying each other with drugs. And the emails that she turned up were these sort of jovial, joking emails about trading things like football tickets for execution drugs. And so she was surprised, as many people have been, by how cavalier these emails about death penalty drugs.
By the way, along the way, you also meet dedicated civil servants, wardens and officials who are assigned with carrying out these death penalty verdicts. You talk about one guy who literally is walking from drugstore to drugstore trying to get the drugs he needs.
And as I began talking to some of these people, it became clear that many of them, not all of them certainly, but many of them are, as you say, dedicated civil servants. Some of them are ambivalent about the death penalty, but feel that they're sort of fulfilling a job that's important. A judge, a jury has decided. In some cases, they were lawyers. The general counsel for the Department of Corrections, who his faith was first and foremost to the Constitution, and he believed this was him upholding the Constitution.
Right.
So when these drug shortages began, these people were desperate to try to get a hold of drugs. And you have these very surreal scenes where people are, as you say, walking into compounding pharmacies and saying, well, can I get the drug from you? Can I get the drug from you?
So there's that. But bring us to 2013. Florida claims to have carried out an execution that was successful with midazolam, and now other states are looking at that. What is midazolam?
So midazolam is basically an anti-anxiety sedative that's used sometimes in surgery, although almost never without another more powerful anesthetic. It is not an analgesic, which means it has no painkilling properties. Doctors are not in total agreement, but generally do not rely on this drug to create the deep coma-like state that is needed for what we consider to be anesthesia.
Well, and that brings us to the centerpiece of your piece, which is that Oklahoma decides to use it in the execution of Clayton Lockhart. By any account, his crimes were horrific. Shot a young girl point blank when she refused to keep his crimes a secret. Then he has his accomplices bury her alive. But what happens in his execution?
On the evening of his executions, the problems began almost immediately, beginning at about 5:27 when they began trying to place an IV. And it took the better part of an hour to place an IV, which is extraordinary. This just never happens for anyone in the medical profession. No one can explain why. The execution started more than 20 minutes late. The moment the first drugs were administered, almost immediately the IV infiltrated, which means it was no longer in the vein. The drugs were, rather than going directly into his bloodstream through his veins, were actually just sort of infusing into his tissue. So he was getting a smaller dose of a drug that didn't even really have the effect that it was thought to have.
But they don't know that. And so they keep the IV thinking that it's going into the veins. And you paint a picture. I mean, at a certain point, people are yelling out, he's trying to get off the table. I mean, he literally comes alive after everyone thought he was dead.
Yeah, I mean, one of the witnesses, a victim service advocate, recounted it as being like a horror movie. As at one point, when the doctor finally approached Lockhart, finally decided that something had to be wrong and approached him to inspect the IV site, this victim service advocate reported seeing Lockhart get up and look right at the doctor and open his eyes.
So he ultimately, after 43 minutes, dies. But that case is completely shadowing the case that's before the Supreme Court that's brought by other Oklahoma death row inmates. We've heard a little bit of how the court has responded, how the justices have responded to some of the arguments from both sides. And again, what seems to be on trial is not lethal injections as much as midazolam. What have they said?
Yeah, well, I think you're exactly right. I think that this could be a very narrow ruling that just has to do with midazolam and not lethal injection, more broadly speaking. I mean, it could be the kind of thing that spawns other challenges. Certainly there'll be other challenges to whatever the next drug that's used is, if indeed midazolam is ruled to be a violation of the Eighth Amendment's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. But I don't think there are many people, even in the legal field, who expect this to be a very broad ruling.
Well, and Justice Alito, his calling it kind of a guerrilla war against the death penalty, he said that. But on the other hand, Justice Elena Kagan is pointing out that the third drug in Oklahoma's protocol, this is in the three-drug cocktail, which is potassium chloride, has been likened to being burned alive, but she said we can't tell. Talk about that aspect of this.
Oh, right. So to have potassium chloride administered, if you're not really anesthetized, is extraordinarily painful. But the other thing is that the second drug that's been used in almost all of the three-drug cocktails is a muscle relaxant or a paralytic. So it might be the case that, for example, the Clayton Lockett execution was so extraordinary, not because of how poorly it went, but because we could see it. There are a lot of questions about other executions and whether people were experiencing this extreme agony but simply couldn't move or speak because they were paralyzed, yeah. And also whether they would be actually experiencing air hunger. I mean, they would be suffocating.
And, of course, we should say there are people who ask, who cares? These are people who have done horrific things, and yeah. So that question is raised as well, but then there's the constitutionality, cruel and unusual punishment. So it may or may not go broader. But in any case, if they side with these inmates and rule against the use of midazolam, the way you've laid it out, it doesn't seem as if there's anything else available.
Yeah. I mean, it would create likely another scramble for execution drugs. I mean, there's very little medical expertise that's being brought to bear here because there are very few doctors who want anything to do with this, and fewer as it gains more and more traction sort of in the public eye.
Jeffrey Stern, who takes on the issue of the lack of drugs in the U.S. for lethal injections, his cover story in The Atlantic is called The Execution of Clayton Lockett. We'll link you at hereandnow.org, and we'll keep an eye on the Supreme Court case with this background. Jeffrey, thank you.
Thank you so much, Robin. Really appreciate it.
We're here to announce a major law enforcement action against international financial institutions that for years participated in a brazen display of collusion and foreign exchange rate market manipulation.
U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch speaking today as five major banks agreed to plead guilty to criminal charges in a long-running investigation into foreign currency manipulation. J.P. Morgan Chase, Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland, Citigroup, and UBS will also pay nearly $6 billion in combined penalties to U.S. and U.K. authorities. Reporter Matt Klein has been following the story for the Alphaville blog of the Financial Times. He's with us from New York. And first, explain how the foreign exchange rate market works and what these banks were allegedly doing to manipulate it.
So let's say you're an American manufacturer, you make cars, and you need to buy auto parts from a company in Japan. The only way to do that is if you have yen. So you have to go to a bank to churn your dollars into yen. Most of the time, if you do that, you don't care about exactly what time of day because this is a long-running contract you have with the supplier. So you just say, buy it at the price for the day. There's a regular price that's set at 4 p.m. every day called the fix, which is based on whatever the last trade was at 4, and many companies will use that as their reference price. The banks are accused of constructing trades just before 4 p.m. so that they could essentially manipulate the benchmark to be advantageous to them relative to wherever they bought their currency earlier in the day and make a profit at the expense of their customers.
And probably something so small on an individual trade that you wouldn't even notice it, or is that the case?
It would be very hard to tell that you'd noticed it. I mean, there's also sort of the question of what it means. I mean, it wouldn't be the best price that you could have gotten earlier in the day, but technically you didn't ask for the best price. You asked for the price at 4 p.m. So there's sort of a tricky question there of how much of it was manipulation and how much of it wasn't. I mean, in this case, we know there was collusion. There are chat rooms, this group called the Cartel that was involved. But it's very difficult to quantify the specific losses to any individual customer.
Well, and did these manipulations impact regular people who were doing business with the banks or who were trying to, you know, change their dollars into euros or something like that?
So I would say indirectly, yes. The basis of all or most financial regulation in the U.S. and elsewhere is that you have to have integrity of the markets, that people have to trust that when you make a deal with someone that they're not defrauding you in some way. And so to the extent that we have evidence here of collusion and of deliberate manipulation, then that's a problem because it raises the cost of doing business. And it makes it that much harder, people less likely to want to trade currencies for goods and services and assets, and it's going to make things more difficult. For the person going to Europe, they might not see it, but there is some cost in terms of growth. It's like insider trading for stocks.
Okay. The question is then, is $6 billion, this total amount of fines, is that the cost of doing business or is that a real hit to these banks?
I would say it's the cost of doing business. I mean, if you look at the profit or the revenues that these firms generate from their trading operations in any given quarter and you add it up, this is not going to be that significant. I mean, the share prices of some of these banks actually went up after the deals were announced
wow.
because they were smaller than what people were expecting.
Matt Klein, reporter with Alphaville at the Financial Times. Matt, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And now someone we just want you to meet. Journalist Heather Lindy writes for the Alaska Dispatch News, but she's also responsible for the obituaries for the Chilkat Valley News in her tiny town of Haines, Alaska, population 2,000. How can you possibly find anything new to tell people about someone who's died in a town that small? But Heather does, and as she writes, she finds the good, which have become her words to live by and the title of her new little book, Find the Good. Heather, welcome.
Oh, thank you. It is so nice to be here.
And to this idea that you can find something new about someone that you see almost every day. Start with the story of Russ Murray. He mowed the cemetery. Everybody saw him around town. You and a friend were charged after he died with going to, you know, help clean out his house. He had no family there. What'd you find?
Boxes and boxes of cards, greeting cards that had been sent to him. He had saved, apparently, every card that anyone had ever sent him. And what I learned when I was writing his obituary about that was that he had left home. He had been from Maine, and he had left home and joined the service, and for whatever reason had been out of contact from his family for 38 years. Mm. And it turns out that he reunited with his family at the end of his life, and all those cards and letters had been sent maybe in the last 5 years of his life. I think the thing that I learned from him most, really, or the thing that sticks with me about that obituary, is that when I asked his brother, like, what happened? His brother said to me, it doesn't matter. All that matters is that we found him again and we're reunited and we had a couple of good years together before he died.
And you would not have known this, that you had a prodigal son.
Never, never guessed it in a million years.
And also, his obituary became a message to others, stay in touch.
Yeah, you bet. And, you know, send a card because it matters.
Yeah. So there's, I mean, a story of a man who seemed to lead such a solitary life, but in the end had this lifeline through these cards to people. I mean, just a real sweetness there. Then there's another story about a life that can seem just a traditional, respectable one, but that one that can have a huge impact after death. This is Richard Boyce, a fisherman who was swept overboard
on the 4th of July.
And they could see him. I mean, this was really compelling to read this. They could see him, but
they couldn't reach him.
And
just the current and the way the tides were running, and his youngest daughter was on the boat with him, and the rest of the fleet escorted her home. And it was about a six-hour run from where the fishing grounds were to Haines. And the response to Richard's death was a bunch of women who are from fishing families and fishermen's wives and daughters came up with inflatable suspenders that go on your rain gear, you know, your rubber rain pants that all the fishermen wear. They got them for every single member of our fishing fleet. I think altogether it was about 175 skippers and deckhands in the salmon gillnet fleet out of Haines. And they all said, in memory of Richard Boyce, on them.
Right. We forget what fishermen's outfits look like, but they fill with water, and it's almost impossible for them to stay above water, but these suspenders would help.
Will help, yeah, if they wear them, you know. And that's the other, like, Richard didn't wear a life jacket, and most of the fishermen don't, because they say the snaps and buckles and stuff on them get tangled in the net. That can be worse. And then there's some even that say it's bad luck. If you're wearing a life jacket, then you're going to fall overboard.
But this kind of a story being an obituary is something that makes it so wonderfully local.
Well, yeah. And I think that's, I mean, the reason why I love writing obituaries, love, I mean, that might not be the right word, but why do it? And I've done it now for, I mean, since 1996, I think. I've written probably 400 of them. Because it seems like the more the world gets kind of homogenized, you know, with everything being sort of one, the lives of just regular people aren't celebrated as much. It's just celebrity or famous or important people that get obituaries that you read about now. And so I just think it's really important. To me, it's sort of like that Our Town thing, that someone 100 years from now can go through the archives of the Chilkat Valley News and they can see how real people lived in one small town in these couple of decades and what their lives were like, how they lived, how they died, what was important to them.
Each of these stories that you tell could be a little movie, you know, a little jewel of a movie. Every obituary seems to be a reminder. I mean, it's kind of cliched. Everybody's life is a story, but it's true.
It's true, though. And that's what I try to do when I'm writing them is to, I think to myself, what's the story here? What's the story of their life? And then also, what's the story that, like with Russ's, that someone reading it that didn't even know him might go out and change something or affirm something that they know in that? Like, you don't even have to know Russ to read that story and be moved.
Yeah. Even Clyde has a story in him. Clyde, who told his brother-in-law that if he died, he didn't think anyone would miss him. And the whole town turns out. Why? Tell us about Clyde. Yeah.
Well, Clyde Bell had the seafood kind of store, and his wife next door had a florist shop. And Clyde, he was often, he would sort of stand on the sidewalk and talk to anybody that went by, and he'd usually be nursing a Hams beer, always smoking a cigarette. And he was a very bright guy, and he would stop me when I'm walking downtown, you know, and he would always say something like, you know, hey, gal. You know, did you see last night the sky was all different colors? And I'd say, yeah, you know, it was a beautiful sunset, Clyde. And he'd say, no, those are chemtrails. The government's salting the clouds because they want to warm up Alaska, so we're going to grow wheat. And it's a big strategic thing. And I'd you know, thank him. And we'd have these conversations like this that I didn't actually put in the paper. But I just always enjoyed talking to him.
Yeah. Well, everybody, because it was a small town, must have known that his oldest son, Matt, drowned in a swimming accident, as you write, and that he made the connections that people make because of that. You write about another guy, Steve, who owns a wildlife park, and his ex-wife was killed by a caged tiger in Alaska. And so Clyde was giving fish scraps to feed Steve's animals in the wildlife park. I mean, people, you see all these umbilical cords or, you know, lines that tie people in town together.
Oh, yeah. My neighbor, Elizabeth, had lost her son, young, when he was 22 in a fishing accident. And Clyde always brought her flowers on Mother's Day. Mm. And she told me when he died that Clyde gave away more flowers than Doris sold, that he would just go in there and get bouquets and then show up and give them to people.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about a part of the book, which is the telling of other people's stories. But you also talk about how you are applying this thinking of finding the good to your own life. And I just want to mention one thing that you recommend. Join a choir. Sing. And in your case, the Haynes Women's A Cappella Chorus?
I think at the moment it's the Haynes A Cappella Women's Chorus. Nancy Nash, our director, likes the acronym HAWK.
And you sing at a lot of these funerals.
Yes.
And the power of a song, like you write about singing Hope, the Emily Dickinson poem set to music.
Yeah, Nancy set it to music, yeah.
Yeah, and it's such a wonderful other way to find the good. Just open your mouth.
And I think, too, it's very, I don't know, almost cliche these days, especially sort of in this season, you know, to tell young people, you know, to march to a different drummer and live the way you want to live and all those kind of things. And I think there's really a lot of value in learning how to blend your voice, how to sing with the choir, how to get along with people, how to understand even that collectively you can make something beautiful out of all these different voices and you can blend. And I think that's important.
Well, it strikes me, too, that your definition of singing in a choir, learning to blend, put voices together towards a common goal, a choir is, it's sort of like living in a small town.
Absolutely. Yeah. And there's the thing is, there's people in our choir whose husbands don't speak to each other. But the women, you know, share sheet music.
Yeah.
And I think even that is an example for the rest of the community that we can all agree to keep all the stuff at the door of choir practice and go in and sing. And we just sing because we want to, and we learn songs because maybe someone will ask us to sing it. It's not like we have a regular gig. We're not a church choir or something where there's something all the time. We just have a repertoire that if someone calls us for a wedding or a funeral or a special event that they want us to sing for, we just show up and sing a few songs.
Yeah. It's all in Heather Lindy's new book, Find the Good, Unexpected Life Lessons from a Small Town Obituary Writer. Heather, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Thank you very much for having me.
And ladies and gentlemen, the Haynes A Cappella Women's Chorus. Here and now.
This week in St. Louis, prosecutors said an off-duty white police officer who shot and killed an 18-year-old African-American man last October would not face criminal charges. Yesterday, the victim's family said they'll file a wrongful death lawsuit against the officer. Sounds familiar because these kinds of stories are coming at us on a weekly basis, it seems. So given all that, what motivates someone to become a police officer right now? Amy Radel from Here and Now contributor KUOW in Seattle met with some of Washington State's newest recruits and filed this report.
Many of the recruits at the Washington State Police Academy have policing in their blood. Their parents or grandparents were officers. Stephanie Schendel is not one of them.
I don't come from a law enforcement family. I come from a family full of nurses, actually. So this has been a lot for them.
Schendel never had much exposure to police until she worked as a reporter covering cops and courts for a small newspaper.
Through that line of work, I got to really learn what policing is and what police officers do and the role they play in society. And it was very inspiring, and it inspired me to pursue something more proactive with my own life.
Schendel is wearing the uniform of the Bellevue, Washington Police Department. That's where she'll soon be working. In the last few years, the academy has focused not just on skills and legal issues, but on the role police should play in society. Schendel says she's welcomed the new curriculum, called Blue Courage, as something that benefits police and the public.
The successful police officers who have long careers are people who are well-balanced, not only in their professional life, but also in their personal lives. And to me, that's the way I interpreted the Blue Courage curriculum. It's teaching someone to be well-balanced and to be respectful and to stay grounded in why they chose this profession and why they do this profession.
Joining a police department as police protests dominate the headlines is tough, she says, but in a way, invigorating.
I think that people should scrutinize their government, whether it be the police or politicians. So I think we are going in at an interesting time because there is so much scrutiny. But at the same time, police departments as a whole across the nation need to work on bettering their relationships with the communities that they serve.
Some recruits not only don't have police in their families, but their run-ins with police have left scars. Jack Fain is one of the few minorities coming through the academy. He says his family's background coming from Laos and Cambodia did affect his attitudes toward police.
Honestly, I did have the I hate the police mentality because that's what I was raised around.
One of the instructors asks Fain to tell his class about growing up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, when kids were joining Asian gangs.
You shared a great story with us about being treated suspiciously growing up as a kid, right? And how that made you feel. Could you share that story?
I was just a kid in middle school and just walking down the street with my friend. We lived in a pretty bad neighborhood. And so a cop stopped us and basically accused us of being gang members and told us that we were up to no good and we were just walking through the park. So that was definitely affected me for a long time until I finally had a positive contact with someone who was in law enforcement.
When Fain was 16, a friend's uncle, a police officer, became a role model and a mentor. Now he's training to join the Clark County Sheriff's Office. There's been a lot of discussion of hiring more racial minorities, especially to police other minorities. But the Academy's executive director, Sue Rahr, says she doesn't see much change in the demographics of police hiring, except that they're a little older than in the past.
In terms of the gender diversity and the race diversity, it's not that different than it has been for the last 30 years. What has caught my attention, though, is the diversity of life experience coming in the door.
Life experience, you know, and I was just like, is that another way of saying you're old?
That's Richard Taylor, who's joining the Olympia, Washington Police Department. He's 44 and already spent a career working with juvenile offenders and foster families. Taylor says it's been a little strange to be surrounded by younger recruits, and his 12-year-old daughter's reaction to his career change troubled him.
You know, all the police shows, I mean, they're so, it's all the shooting and you know, police officers getting shot and you know, them being on the news for bad stuff. And she just got real quiet when I talked to her about it, and I knew that she wasn't absolutely okay with it.
But she came around. Taylor says he wouldn't have taken this step without his family's consent. Recruits face a long hiring process. To get to the academy, they've already gone through months of extensive background checks, exams, mental health screenings, even polygraph tests and voice analysis. Training instructors say it's almost impossible to get applicants who have no blemish in their past, from driving infractions to drug use. But these days, they say departments are more interested in finding people who have overcome and learned from their difficulties. For Here and Now, I'm Amy Radel.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.